Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and I sometimes struggle with English too, Mark, thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well, I think it's fair to say that we've rather enjoyed this last week. It's been a while since we've seen a complete and utter demolition of anyone at the Amex, but last Saturday's truly devastating takedown of the once mighty Manchester United has seen some sages declare it as the best Albion performance they have ever seen. And then Monday night saw the club's players' awards night, and we saw Mark Cucurella crown both the players and the fans' player of the season. Although we have to wait a couple of weeks to see if he can make it a hat trick and claim the Roar player of the season as well. I'm digging out my curly wig just in case. Speaking of which, the away end at Elland Road will be full of them as we look to secure our best ever finish. Leeds, though, have issues of their own as they are looking to avoid slipping through the relegation trap door. Joining me today, as we will no doubt eulogise about Saturday's performance, is of course Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back who once made a film about a bloke who I think might have been playing for Man United last Saturday. It's Louis Miles. And we also welcome back Vicky Rees. Well, welcome back to the show, everyone. Lovely to see you, Louis. And the Kaiser was playing for United at the weekend, wasn't he?
I think he was playing up front and in defence and all over the place. I mean, they were shocking, weren't they? Absolutely terrible.
He got them their ladies, didn't he?
He did. He did. I think when it looked like they were having the after effects of a party down in Brighton the night before was the way they were playing. Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah, Vicky, how much did you enjoy Saturday night?
Oh, it was tremendous, wasn't it? It was just one of those, your inner voice sort of says to you, well, come on, they're not actually that good a team, but it's just the occasion, isn't it? There were so many things to like about it, about the performance, about obviously the result, but just so much karma involved, I think. You know, I'd like to think somewhere Steve Foster enjoyed it as well.
Oh, I'd imagine he was partying as hard as the rest of us. I mean, we've had games. We've come away from games where you're buzzing. You're sort of like, you're kind of puffing on the imaginary cigar. You're thinking, yeah, that was good. That was nice. And I'm thinking the likes of Sheffield Wednesday in the season we went up, or, you know, the St. Patrick's Day massacre. But that was on a different level. Yeah. You know, you have to put everything into context that it's in the Premier League, a league we've spent, you know, less than 10% of our history in. And we're playing against Manchester United, who've won the league the most times. And like I say, they are a slight shadow of their former selves, but you can only play what's put in front of you. But, you know, as Vicky said, it's karma. It's, well, no one was calmer after that, but it was absolutely beautiful. It was, and even then, I still think 4-0 flattered Man U. I mean, Louis, you famously have told us you were born on Cup Final Day, so your history is such. But, you know, have you ever seen anything like it?
I haven't, and my wife's a Manchester United fan.
Oh, even better.
So I've been in the doghouse for quite a few days since that result. But I mean, crikey. I mean, I think my first away game was United away as well in 93, was it, when we played them in the FA Cup?
Oh, yeah.
We've played well against big sides so far in the Premier League, but to actually demolish a side and everything go exactly to plan, we haven't seen it against any side, really, have we? And then to do it against them. And it wasn't the greatest Man United team that they could have fielded, but actually with the players that are still able to play for the club, they're only missing one or two. You know, you're only really missing Sancho, I guess, from their summer signings. So it was reasonably strong enough. And Rashford, I think, was out. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, that team has been winning games this season.
Vicky?
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of it for me also was, yeah, I'm not glad. I was still angry before. I was still angry about the penalty in the previous season. I was still angry about.
You read my mind, Vicky.
I thought I would never get over the Bruno Fernandes penalty. You know, he's just one of those players that really grips me. I can't bear him. I hate his little face. I hate his smugness. I hate the fact that he's the penalty. And I took enormous joy in watching his little sad face as that game went on and on and on. And I watched the replay. I watched Match of the Day. I watched it again. And I still kept zoning in on Bruno Fernandes's little sad and little alternately angry face. And it brought me enormous joy just to see him, you know. That game took me such a long time to get over. And I think the only way we were going to get over that was to absolutely smash them. You know, maybe if someone had kind of nailed him as well, but that would be, you know, and very to say that, but you know,
but that's the weird thing in the whole build up to the game. It was all about, you know, and for all that happened, let's face it, we are talking about one of the world's greatest ever footballers was gracing the Amex turf, irrespective of the fact he's obviously in the sunset of his career. We are talking about one of the best players the world has ever seen. Again, clearly a shadow of his former self. But then having said that, when you see that any decent player really does have to have another team alongside him to make them look good, you know, no great player has ever shone in a mediocre side. And the whole thing that you see in retrospect of him laughing, I mean, it is a mirthless laugh. It's not as though he doesn't care about Manchester United. He clearly does. But to see him looking around thinking, and I'd like to think it's not just a case of, you know, hang on, this is only Brighton, what's going on here? Because he's probably seen it four or five times this season of his defence just being turned over. And in that sense, although it shouldn't all be about him, it is such a shame that we as Brighton fans, even though he's an opposition player, didn't get to see Ronaldo do anything on a certain level, just a small level, which will run out. That's a little bit sad.
Man, I had a look today to see when he actually made his debut for United. It was back in 2003. Again, they won 4-0, which is nice, against Bolton. And you know, the players that are in that team that day, you know, you're talking about the Van Nistelrooys, the Keynes, Nevilles, etc. But I mean, that was a team which they would kill for now. Incidentally, that day we beat QPR 2-1. Leon Knight scored twice when he made his debut.
But Louis, all right, we want Brighton to win. We don't want to, you know, make it all about the opposition. I mean, when we first got the stadium, it was Steve Gerrard coming down here and you know, the fact that one of our players did his roof one time, and you think this isn't what it's about. It's not about the hero worship of another opposition player, but you know, I was on a certain level looking forward to seeing Ronaldo play, and we just basically stuffed him, didn't we?
We absolutely did. And I wonder if this is, you know, a real big moment for us as a club. I don't want to sound all emotional or putting a strange narrative to it all, but actually, if you look at our time in the Premier League, we've been always talking about whether we could beat teams in the Big Six and really compete and all the rest of it. And over the last, especially under Potter, we've done a lot better against them. And now I think went into that match fully convinced that we were going to beat them. I didn't have any worries about it whatsoever. And when I saw the team sheet, I thought, well, we're definitely going to beat them now. But, you know, I wonder if that is just a marker in the sand to say, not only can we beat these guys, we are, and I know they're a weaker team than they once were, but we should probably start expecting it every now and again now. And I wonder if that's a psychology change that we as a club, players and fans, and I guess management as well, should take.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about psychology there, Louis, I mean, obviously, I mean, we're going into these games without fear now because, you know, I mean, we went up to Anfield and we should have probably won. And, you know, it took them from October to this weekend for anyone else to take at least a point from them up there. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've gone to like City. Okay, we lost to City up there, but you know we went without fear. We're at Spurs, no fear. To Arsenal, no fear. These are teams when we first came up. You know, we were meant to be frightened of. We're not. They should be frightened of us now.
Well, I think they are as well. I mean, we were talking about Ronaldo earlier and saying it's potentially only Brighton. I mean, everyone I speak to in football who works within it has an ultimate respect for what we are these days under Graham Potter. And I mean, it's the simple narrative that everyone keeps on popping up with, which is we just need to find someone to put the ball in the back of the net. Probably rings true a bit. We are a very good side that have had not the luck of the draw that we should have had. Well, everything that we touched on Saturday went into the back of the net, and we probably should have had two or three more. You know,
oh, Vic, I just want to bring you in here because obviously you've been to games in recent. I mean, this is probably arguably the best sort of 4 or 5 weeks that we've had, certainly since we got into the Premier League. Yes, we've had some nice results, but we've beaten Arsenal and Spurs and Manchester United. But I think that there was an air of, especially after that 2 week break and the kind of sodding typicalness of only drawing to Norwich. I mean, I know how I felt, but let me ask you, did you have an inkling that we could do it against the likes of Arsenal or Spurs or even Manchester United before you got to those games? Or was that, you know, wishful thinking? How did you feel about those games?
I think after the Norwich game, I mean, the fact that we didn't manage to win, it kind of took away. I actually thought they played pretty well against Norwich. I it wasn't a bad performance. They totally dominated the game. But as usual, you know, couldn't hit the proverbial cow's backside with a banjo. But I think, you know, I went up to Arsenal expecting to win, I'd be lying. I must admit, I had got to a point when I thought, looking at the remaining fixtures, where are we going to get the points just to make sure? You know, anyone else outside the club looks at it and goes, Brighton are fine, Brighton are safe, they're kind of mid-table. I think for most of us, you know, we tend to still, when it's your own club, you always kind of sit there calculating every unlikely possibility, don't you? And I think I sat there thinking, well, okay, we don't really tend to beat Southampton at home. We've then got Arsenal and Spurs away. You know, we've got Man United who always get the refereeing decisions. We've got Wolves who kind of had started to break the jinx in recent years. You know, when are we going to get these points from? And even Leeds was away, wasn't it? And Leeds were on a revival. So, and then suddenly it just seemed to, it's like the switch has been flipped for the players. But I think what's also been nice with this is that the performances have been getting better and better throughout, even throughout that little spell. I mean, the Southampton one, okay, the second half against... The first half, they played pretty well. Second half was pretty poor, very poor. But Arsenal, they played well. Spurs was a different sort of performance, but still a good one. Playing Wolves away, they were brilliant. You know, they completely dominated that game from minute one, and they looked like they wanted to do that as well. They were really... you can argue that Wolves' season's kind of over. Are they on the beach and that? But, you know, they still managed to win last week. And then United, and you know, there's been 2 goals, 3 goals, 4 goals. Even that, they seem to have suddenly cottoned on to how to find the back of the net. And it's weird because it's been since Morpay's been out the side. But you know, it's unfortunate.
Is it because Welbeck stretches? I mean, I think there's a Caicedo factor, but is it also because Welbeck stretches the defence, whereas Morpay comes deep to get the ball?
I don't know, because there were times earlier in the season when I thought, you know, we played better with Morpay in the side and his movement was a lot more... Certainly when you compared his movement to someone like Connolly when he was in the side, it was worlds apart. And actually when the games that Welbeck played earlier in the season, I remember thinking, I'm not sure he's going to get another contract. Whereas now I feel like they'd be mad not to offer him another contract.
Absolutely, yeah.
In recent weeks, you know, he hasn't necessarily got loads of goals in that, but he's played really, really well.
I mean, I don't think you could ever accuse Morpay of like not putting a shift in, even if he's missing easy chances. And he's always worked hard for the team. And in fact, he did actually start that game against Southampton, I think, as well, alongside Welbeck. But yeah, I mean, you're right, Lou. I mean, the difference that Welbeck makes, a fit Danny Welbeck makes when he is running those channels, and he's I mean, you know, he's an outlet for the pings of Robert Sanchez, and you know a couple of times he's actually found him with those runs, and you know, I mean, years ago I guess you could have maybe called it, I don't know, route one to a certain degree, hit the big man up front, but it's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, if you're going to look at the minutiae of the game, he could have had a hat trick. I mean, I know that you're going to go through this bit by bit, but there was the lob over the bar, which was unlucky. There was the fact he was going to score before a Man U player hooked it off the line and only for Trossard to follow up, you know, 5 inches behind him. And then his pile driver, his Bobby Charlton-esque pile driver that went inches wide. You know, and that's a bloke who's sniffing out the goals. So it's not just pulling the teams apart. It's actually, you know, being close to scoring himself. He could have had a hat trick. And you think, well, given that he didn't get any, what on earth could the scoreline have been?
Yeah, I mean, he was instrumental in an awful lot of our excellent plays with that. But we're going to have a look at that performance in a minute. But I just want to rewind a bit and talk about the atmosphere at the ground, because often it's been a mausoleum, I guess, as many people call it. There's been booze, there's been all sorts of things this year. But from minute one on Saturday, the ground was absolutely rocking and they were well up for it. I mean, it's you know, there's often that thing, you know, the team, we wait for the team to lift the crowd or for there to be a bad decision from the referee or for a bad tackle for the crowd to get up. But this time, the crowd were just gung-ho from it, right from the second, Vix.
Yeah, and I think one thing that felt really different after the game, and I fully accept there's a 4-0 win's always going to brighten the place up, but you know, even when we have won the odd other game this season, there hasn't been that kind of buzz in it. And it felt like walking around the Amex after the match had finished, it just kind of had that feeling of those early days. And I know, I think perhaps the pandemic's played a big role, because you know, so many people, you know, there are still people who aren't coming to games. People are gradually coming back, and I think the stadium's been fuller as the season's gone on, with people sort of feeling safer and feeling more able to come back. But just that kind of thing, even in the last couple, you know, there's been a lot more people hanging around outside afterwards. Yeah, of course, the weather helps, but you know, when the sun's shining and you've won a game and people are all singing around and bouncing and you know, singing new songs about amazing Ecuadorian players, which I'm sure you're going to get onto, because I can't stop singing that one all week.
Fair enough. But Louis, surely this kind of sort of happiness. I mean, Vicky just said she walked around. I think that most of us floated around, but I guess that probably coming off the back of a very encouraging and healthy 3-0 win the week before probably kind of helps people's minds as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the run we've been on has been absolutely fantastic. That improves spirits. I think we were already safe from relegation pretty much going into that game. Like, you know, something completely random would have had to have happened over the course of events to keep us in play. I think the weather would have helped. I think the time kickoff. I certainly was a couple of pints deep before I got in there.
Surely not.
When I saw the team as well, the Man United team, I thought we're better than this lot. You know, yeah. I think that, and from minute one, I mean, I know you're saying about the team have to lift the players, the team have to lift the crowd, or does the crowd lift the team, or the rest of it? From kickoff, we were at them. Dominating the press, like really, really up for it. And we, you know, Potter spotted what their weaknesses were, which is getting down the flanks and pressurizing them. And we absolutely dominated them from that minute one. And look, I mean, it only takes one good tackle to get the crowd going, you know.
Absolutely.
I think you could narrow down their weaknesses sort of more broadly than that to defending and midfield.
Or playing football.
Having this sort of blur of red called Scott McTominay.
Yeah, well, but I'm
zeroing in on him, because not only was he awful, he was just fouling, and he just would not get booked. But thankfully, he was probably, you know, one of our men of the match. So I suppose probably on a certain level, hurrah for him.
Yeah, but it was awful. But I mean, but in regards to the game with the crowd, it was like the perfect storm coming together, really. It was just everything was lifting everyone, and it was just, I can't remember an atmosphere at the Amex since the Sheffield Wednesday playoff game.
About to say, the shades of the Sheffield Wednesday playoff, but when, to be honest, you know, we've been asked to raise the roof, we've been asked to make a noise, and there was actually 4,000 people fewer that day. But we've been asked to do so. But yeah, you could, in fact, even watching up Match of the Day, you can see there's a crescendo, or maybe it's just the recordings of it, but there's a crescendo of the goals going in. I mean, as each one went in, and obviously with the 2, 3, and 4 being in such close proximity in time, you know, and each one going, getting noisier and noisier. If we'd have got a fifth about a couple of minutes after Trossard's goal, I don't know how I would have been able to do it. I'd have just gone, yeah, goal, fine. Because you're all out of screaming by that point, surely.
Well, I don't know. I remember when we beat Blackpool 6-1 and we scored all 7 goals. I mean, I celebrated all of them, even Dean Hammond's goal. That was brilliant.
Yeah, but you didn't celebrate then as madly as you did on Saturday, surely.
No, no, maybe Orlandi's.
The only time we've celebrated as mad as that, that I can think of, is one, that Sheffield Wednesday game where, you know, Murray got sent off, or the St. Patrick's Day massacre. Or maybe the other Palace game when Andoni ran and outpaced his man, because that was a fantastic bit of flying skill. But that's, you know, apart from that, you know, that is as mad as I've ever gone at the Amex. And it was so good for it. Come on, let's break the game down, mate.
Okay, well, I mean, it was a day where our good friend Brian Owen was handing out perfect 10 scores in the Argus. But who stood out for you, Louis?
All of them. I think who got man of the match officially at the ground? Was it Caicedo? I can't remember now. He got the Sky one, but I think Pascal Gross was.
It was Cucurella who got it, I think.
Was it Cucurella? Yeah. For me, Pascal Gross was the standout player out of all the stand-up players. It looks like he's going to go at the end of the season, which is, I think, a real shame, because when he does play, he's just so effective, and he set up lots of chances there and just threaded the perfect balls through. Mm. But look, you know, underrated shout for another man of a match would be Alexis McAllister, who just seemed to fulfil several different roles in one. But yeah, all of them. I mean, you know, even all the way back to the keeper. I mean, look at the great saves that Sanchez made. Could have seeded a couple.
Alexis is a funny one for me at the moment. I mean, he's sort of become the water carrier to a certain degree. He's doing an awful lot of the hard work, which you don't necessarily pick up on, but he just seems to be absolutely everywhere.
Vix? Yeah, I think I'd say the same. I mean, he, you know, it was a similar sort of thing at Wolves. Some of obviously the sort of ice cold second penalty was great there, but I think, yeah, but we need someone to have that role, someone that is perhaps capable of sitting deep. You know, he's not doing the Bissouma tackling role or even the Caicedo tackling role, but he's got a really good eye for a pass, McAllister, as well. And, you know, he's one of those ones that can just sort of put his foot on it, and he's got the awareness of what's going on around him. And what I loved about that game, well, one of the things, but the number of short, sharp, quick passes, back flicks, you know, these back heels that were going in. I mean, that is a sign of a team playing with huge amounts of confidence, because you don't start doing back heels and back flicks, do you, when you're worried about losing the ball? And, you know, just watching that, it was Olay football, wasn't it, at times?
Yeah.
When that was going on. I'm, you know, not necessarily as a man of the match, because there was loads, but I am also just going to put in a little word for Solly March as well, because he's been great in the last few games. And I've started to feel like he's kind of turning into the Solly March that we hoped he would. Now, again, he's another one that, does he stay in, you know, does he look for, you know, is he looking for more game time going on, because he hasn't had that much this season? But actually, he's, you know, recently he's sort of become the player that we maybe hoped he might. He was really good at Wolves the weekend, and he's kind of almost turning into a winger again.
Well, it's a funny one, because he was kind of occupying the right back role, or right wing back role, that Tarek Lamptey's had. I mean, and I've often said on the show over the years that I've always preferred Solly on the right. I mean, when he was at his most scintillating best, when he was totally box office, when he was just actually had everyone on toast on that right hand side for a while.
The game that I always, I think that probably, if for the sake of argument, I hope it doesn't happen that Solly's career was certainly Solly's career was to end with Brighton tomorrow. The one game that people would talk about is that game at Birmingham, where he came on as a substitute 15, 20 minutes to go. In fact, I remember watching it at your house, Vicky, for your birthday. And we all got a bit excited, and then we joined you for your party, but he came on and completely stole the show. But the weird thing is that you're saying you prefer him on the right. As a left wing back, he can do a job, but I can't help feeling his talents are wasted there. And so in that sense, yes, out on the right, he can do a hell of a lot of damage, but he does the one thing that you always hate, AD, which is to cut inside and then play in the kind of the in-swinging ball. And the number of times you've moaned about that, because what he's not, when he plays on the right, is someone who goes down to the goal line in order to pull
Which is what he was doing on the right when he first got into the team. That's exactly what he was doing.
But he doesn't really have a... he does have a right foot. He just doesn't use it. Was it last season? He scored that great goal away at Aston Villa with his right foot. And you think, well, you know, you're trying to, you see him cutting across the area, looking for the opportunity to shoot. And you think, you know, well, use your right foot, mate. But yeah, I mean, I think Vicky's point is, it's not just the fact he was using his skill, but him and Gross were linking up beautifully. But also he was using his strength as well. And that's not something you normally associate with him. So, yeah, again, another bit of advancement, bit of improvement from Solly March. And I think probably by the time he gets to the age of 34, it'd be brilliant.
Yeah. Well, this is something you just alluded to, something I've got written down here, Albert, which is, I mean, we had the partnerships that we've been building well over the pitch. It's just so wonderful to watch. And, you know, and we mentioned it earlier in the show that Moise Kotedo is just... He's just.
I will get you to say his name properly one day.
Kotedo.
It's Casado.
Casado. Oh, there you go.
He's not Italian.
Well, you know, I like.
Where's he from, Vix?
He's from Ecuador.
Yeah.
Do you know why he came over here?
Do tell.
To win the Ballon d'Or.
Uh huh. Sorry, what were you saying about Kotedo?
Casado. Basically, I mean, his partnership, I mean, he's got with Bissouma, that they're working together in tandem. You've got other partnerships all over the pitch. You've got Veltman and Dunk. It's everywhere. You're just seeing everyone's working as a team together. And, you know, and there's a thing that Man City do where they have the turnover of the ball really quickly. If they lose the ball, they try and win it back within 5 seconds. We're doing that, and we're hunting down teams in packs. If we lose the ball, we've got two players going to get the ball back. It's just been absolutely amazing to watch, and it's work that's been put on the training ground.
Absolutely, but you say that even in terms of, you know, you're talking about partnerships. I think you're picking up on what Janus was trying to say, and I thought, well, I don't think he's necessarily getting the point there, because if you're saying, right, you've got Casado alongside Bissouma, and then Casado go bombing forward and he's alongside McAllister's then going to be alongside Gross, but then Gross is over there, so he's going to be with Solly March has just cut in, so he's going to be playing to Danny Welbeck, and these things are all over the place. The point
I had
is
no that idea we had Peter O'Sullivan on the show today.
Yeah, he is the world's worst ex-Albion player to be interviewed. We know.
I was talking about the racing commentator, but it was.
So, I mean, the point is, Louis, and you've seen this. Could you actually have a go at explaining and describing a Graham Potter lineup?
Well, I think it depends which game that we're playing. So, when we're playing Spurs away, we very clearly had two sixes in defence, essentially. Allowing sort of a rotating front four. But against United, and I think we've played this against other teams as well, it seems like we almost have like a centre-back pairing of one, which is Dunk at the back. Because Cucurella, effectively, we were 3-5-2 on Saturday, right?
In theory,
yeah. But Cucurella was never really in the centre-back position unless he was defending. And Veltman was almost pushed onto the right wing as well, which effectively meant that... Trossard and Solly March weren't playing left and right wing back. They were playing as left and right wingers. But the point is that when they go forward, then Bissouma and or Caicedo or Gross or McAllister, whoever happened to be around, would fall back in a centre partnership with Dunk if there were too many people going forward. And I think that's where we're seeing this more attacking Albion after the international break, where that's coming from. Certainly, I mean, in my sort of non-football analyst hat, that seems to be what's happening because, you know, there's not three centre-backs on that pitch, right? But because everyone's willing to do a shift, I mean, Trossard's not really a left-winger, is he? But they've put him out there. And now he's created a fantastic partnership on that side, right?
And your leading scorer, Vicky?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just can't help thinking, can you honestly have imagined if someone had said to you even 10 years ago that we'd be playing at the Amex with three men in defence against Cristiano Ronaldo and winning 4-0. I mean, that's the things I can't...
One man in defence.
One man in defence. Like, you know, two centre-halves there, maybe, if you're saying Duncan Veltman. Oh, we'll just chuck one out. We'll just chuck a full-back in as well, just for a laugh. This is what makes... all just so completely insane, isn't it? You know,
sounds like Sammy Hippier's wet dream, doesn't it?
Okay, well,
that's the great thing to put in my mind. If that's the last thing that goes through my mind as I'm drifting off to sleep tonight, Louis, thanks very much.
Well, it's not far off what he was playing. It's just we've got the players to do it now, I think.
It'd be interesting now to actually kind of revisit Hoopier's tactics because, I mean, I remember Inigo Calderon saying that the bloke was kind of tactically very, very advanced, but I just think he didn't have the players who could understand what it was he was going on about. I mean, at least when Gus came, you know, the players might have been a third division level, but they actually took on board what he was trying to say, and it was kind of revolutionary. I'd be interested to know, you know, if there was ever a football tactician, because when we watched Tupia's team play, we're all going, what on earth is going on here? And yet, if you probably saw it alongside Potter, I wouldn't mind betting. I mean, it's a bit of a punt, but I wouldn't mind betting that they're probably from the same school of thought. It's just that, you know, when you've got a lower second division side trying to actually play that way, then it does it's probably going to unravel very, very quickly.
Well, I think that's exactly what happened under Hippie. I mean, I remember I was doing some work at the BBC at the time and remember seeing one of their stats department when I went up to Salford, and they said, oh, Brighton are the unluckiest team in European football. And this was like November time, maybe. And I was like, really? And he said, yeah, this is in the early days of XG before it became on match day and all the rest of it. And they're saying, if you analyse everything, Brighton have loads of chances, don't score them and concede stupid goals. It's just the rubber of the green's not going for you. And I was like, oh, okay, blimey. And then I do remember actually he was playing pretty all right in some of those matches. Yeah. Not all of them. I mean, obviously the Millwall one was dreadful, which was like the end. Yeah. But it wasn't far off. And I think you're right, Alan. I think if you it's okay doing this with Pascal Gross and, you know, an Argentinian number 10 and Caicedo and all the rest of it, and not with Chris O'Grady and Danny Holler and who else was in that team.
I was about to say that Hoopier would rather have Caicedo than Gary Gardner, but you know it's. Well, let's have a look at the goals then, and the first one. I mean, I guess it can only be described as a daisy cutter nutmeg of sorts. It was
I think the Telegraph described it as a grubber. Yeah, Vix. It was not that we actually want to sort of like get you to describe probably the fourth best goal of the game.
Well, yeah, but I mean that's been the problem, hasn't it? That's exactly what we haven't been able to do for. Ooh, 2 or 3 years probably. And so having someone that's, you know, he still had the work to do, didn't he? And he pinged it in the bottom corner. I mean, it was probably helped by Lindelof, because I'm not quite sure what, you know, I still watch that and think he was trying to perform the Charleston or something. But, you know, I don't know if you've seen the sort of slow motion from behind where his kind of knees have turned in towards each other and he's just got a really confused look on his face as it goes through his legs. And then obviously I don't think that helps De Gea. But yeah, daisy cutter, yeah. But it was strange because I had this sort of thought in my head before the game of who would, you know, the players that I would most like to see score today. And the reason I thought it was because they were both players that I thought would really appreciate it. You know, there's nothing better than a player that scores a goal and then really gives it the beans, isn't it? Because, you know, when you've got someone that's, you know, oh yeah, thanks very much, lovely. It's much better when they're really going for it. And I thought, who would really go for it? Well, I thought Caicedo, because he hasn't scored before and he's a youngster and it would probably be a big deal for him. And of course, I thought Cucurella as well, because you know, he's just Cucurella, isn't he? So, you know, the two players that I most wanted to score both got goals. And it was brilliant. Everything was brilliant. Of course it was. But
I'm delighted for Caicedo's goal. But I mean, wouldn't it... if Gross's shot had like arrowed into the top corner, that just because I mean that stayed hit. I mean I don't know which defender it actually cannoned off that
I'm
went
not
out.
Sure, that defender still knows now.
Oh my god, that was arrowing straight into the top corner like an exocet. It was absolutely.
Oh. But anyway. Sorry, you know, so look, if we go on to the second goal, before I do, I mean, we're talking about, you know, your point is absolutely spot on, Vicky, about who. You know, there was a certain level of there's obviously the majesty of the game itself, but then the sort of like the kind of human element of two debut goal scorers. And I'm going to throw this one out there. Maybe I'm taking this a bit far, but let's go with you first, Louis, because it is a bit of a bloke question I'm asking here. Is has Mark Cucurella already achieved the status of man love that Calderon and Bruno could command, or is he not quite there yet?
My nephew was at the Player Awards on Monday night, and he met Mark Cucurella, and he got a message from my sister, who sort of liked football, was not really into it and goes occasionally, doesn't really know who the players were, and she was over the moon to receive. And he said, "Joe, you're lovely," on a video message to her, and she sent it to all of her friends, and I got jealous. We've not been blessed with many great left backs, I think, in our AMEX years. Probably Wayne Bridge has been the best of the bunch prior to Cucurella coming in, and I think his just everything about him I absolutely love. I'm very glad to see that he's won both those awards, and I was super happy, like Vicky, that he scored the goal all weekend.
But although Gonzalo Yarrarayas is going to be disappointed with you for saying that, but you know,
that's Joe Bennett.
But yeah, I mean that Cucurella goal. I mean, it. I mean, how much did it mean to? I mean, in the words of the great Barry Davis, just look at his face. It was just.
I'm not putting that out there, but no, it was. Yeah, you could. Apparently, the play when they got back into the dressing room after Cucurella was asked to do his 400th interview of the afternoon. When he got back in with Lewis Dunk, they all started mock sobbing for him. So I think he might have been brought down to earth fairly soon afterwards.
I think you could clearly tell he's been doing a lot of English lessons, because in every interview and on the Player Awards evening, he said the same form of words about life being a bit difficult when I've turned up in England and I came with my baby who had 10 days old, and yeah. My wife was there for me. And,
He'd read the script.
He knew what he knew. I mean, having learned another language later in life, I'm exactly the same. So, you know what you know and you don't what you don't.
Well, he knows how to talk Hackney Marshes, ear gaffer.
Okay, well, let's talk about the best goal of the game. In my opinion, might not be yours, but it certainly is mine. And that was the Pascal Gross goal, which all started with the ping from... Bob Sanchez.
Vicky, we've seen that before, haven't we? That ping.
Oh yeah, it's one of those ones, isn't it? When Edison does it, the whole world wants to talk about it. But you know, other goalkeepers, there are maybe not Nick Pope, for example, but when other goalkeepers out there who do it, that is one of Sanchez's attributes. Yes, there have been some that have. There was a point during the season when his radar was a little bit off. Probably like the same as the radar that was affecting his hands a bit at one stage. But I think what was nice is that Potter has stuck with him, and I think you're really seeing his confidence coming back now. He's a very good ball player, and that's backed up by the stats. You know, if you follow, there's a Twitter account which talks about, it's full of goalkeeping stats, and I'm nerdy enough to follow that one. And you know, one of the real positives for him is his distribution. He rates very highly that, and one-on-ones, for which he's second only to Alisson in the Premier.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, which you don't necessarily think of, but
no.
Alisson is leagues above everyone. I think it's a hugely high number, but Sanchez is second, and then there's two more, and then everyone else is a long way behind. So,
sure.
It was a thing of beauty, that pass.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was a pass. It wasn't a hoof, was it?
No. No, and the takedown from Cucurella on that was absolutely delightful as well.
I mean, the similarities between that goal and the second one at Anfield, the ball out wide, then the cut in, the wait for the pass to the eventual scorer, who takes a touch around the defender before sticking it into the back of the net. You know, all right, Man United, don't get me wrong, they're not listening to Rangnick at all, but like I say, there's a carbon copy to that. And you know, it's not just, it's, I hate the phrase possible, but it's something they clearly work on, and not many teams, if you've got Liverpool and Man United, that can't cope with it. I mean, Louis, does it actually rate up there for one of your goals of the season?
I think it does. I mean, I think I'd actually forgotten about Mwepu's goal against Liverpool, which I think probably was a worthy winner. But yeah, I mean, it was just a beautiful move, and it's one of those, if it's made by Arsenal or Manchester City, everyone talks about it ad infinitum. I think what I found interesting was that, you know, those Man United watch-alongs, which everyone's been watching since
yeah,
the...
I think we've all seen those.
We've all seen those. And there's the famous one, was it Goldbridge or whatever his name is. He actually nails the analysis pretty correctly, which is United have made all these changes at half-time, taking off probably their best player in Matic, I think, and took off Elanga, who was actually tracking Cucurella for most of the first half. And then they just kept the whole thing completely open for us to an attack. It was wonderful. And it was lovely that it's Pascal Gross. And I didn't realise he hadn't scored this season. And
no,
he absolutely deserves one.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to argue the fact that he has scored, and I'm still maintaining it was a legitimate goal, although VAR incorrectly, in my view, ruled it out, the goal against Southampton. And that was an absolute pinger as well.
Yeah.
It was a delightful goal. But I mean, when Trossard found Gross, I mean, he still had a lot to do. We all love it when someone puts someone on their backside, don't we? And but it was such a delightful finish. And, you know, it kind of reminded me of Morpé's goal at Leeds a little bit, although the finish against Man United was better. But the way that the move...
It's also additional to the fact that, you know, and we're back to the atmosphere again. I mean, clearly by this time we're 2-0 up, the crowd's lifted. It's a dangerous score because we've been at 2-0 in the recent times and not taken full advantage of it. And here we are, then we get this third. And I love the fact that 2, 3, and 4 were so close together that by the time we got to start singing We Want 5, you realise we didn't actually have time to start singing We Want 3 or We Want 4. And it's, for me, those are the best goals that you can have, especially when you're thrashing a really good team, is when you've just finished celebrating and the ball goes in again. And I'm thinking back to Fulham away in the season we went up, where we were absolutely being bulldozed. We get our penalty and then Lewis Dunk comes up with a follow-up 2 minutes later, by which time... you know that, you know, everyone's absolutely knackered. And come the fourth goal, we're jumping around so hard, cheering like sort of Derbyshire so hard. You're thinking, you know, all right, boys, well done, declare.
Yeah, that fourth goal as well. I mean, I did feel for Danny Welbeck because he really did deserve a goal on the game. But
you love him, don't you? Well, you love him.
I think he's great. Yeah, I think he's wonderful. I really, really hope he's going to be here next season. But you know, I mean, Trossard had to wait for the VAR decision. But I did like the fact he still did it, his little binocular celebration up to his son in the crowd after once the VAR decision was gone. That was quite delightful. Okay, so
in the great scheme of things, I've got to say this to, I'll ask this to Vicky and to Louis. Vicky, do you want to go first? Now, you've been watching the Albion for years. Where does that rate in terms of performance and in terms of result and context and what have you?
How do you start it? I mean, I wasn't around for the kind of the previous First Division era, so I can't sort of compare visually. I've not seen all of those games. I think the vast majority of the team that we've got now would have them on toast, that side in the early 80s, you know, much as there were some good players in there. I think it's a tough one because we know that Man United have been a bit of a faded force this season. They weren't great, but it was such an all-round performance, wasn't it? There was everybody in that team played well, and that you don't always get that. You might have a game where you score a lot of goals and you can't say that the goalkeeper's done anything, or you can't say that the defence have done much. But it was kind of almost perfection, wasn't it? Yeah, maybe if we got the 8 that I was hoping for, it would have been perfection.
it would take 8 to erase that memory of that game last season. But
we've had some really good performances in the Premier League without necessarily getting the results. So it's right. A tough one to call. But, I mean, he's got to be up there, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, Louis? Sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd agree. I mean, I think other games might mean more in terms of, you know, Sheffield Wednesday and all the rest of it. But, you know, I bet if you go back and look at those games now, even the Palace 3-0 one, it's not as a complete performance as that. Against it, as I say, they didn't necessarily have all the best players up there, but it wasn't a completely, you know, awful United lineup. I thought we should have won it, but look at it. We still had Bruno Fernandes in there and Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, it's his good side. And we absolutely dominated them. Yeah, De Gea, you know. I mean, my mum and dad now live in Plymouth, and they were out for the weekend, and you know, they've went through watched Brighton since the '80s as well, right? And they we all just said like we dreamt of days like this. We never thought they would happen, and here you are. They are happening, and you know, it's kind of everything that we hoped for.
And it was lovely that Stuart Sorrow was there to see it.
Exactly.
And taking a slight left turn from the Raw and all our ranting about beating Manchester United, it's been a while on the Raw since we've had anyone on from Albion the Community. Now, AITC themselves have had a little bit of a shutdown during lockdown. All their activities have had to be put on the back burner for the time being, but they're ramping up their events now. And I'm delighted to say that as part of the marketing and fundraising team, I'm joined by Nikki Jars of Albion the Community. And I understand, Nikki, this is a fairly new venture for you. So A, welcome to the Albion Roar, and B, well, welcome to Albion the Community. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm really well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here working for AITC and excited about a programme of events that we've got coming up and getting things back going again.
Great stuff. So tell us a bit about yourself, your background and how you got this particular gig.
Well, I've always worked in the charity sector in London and in Brighton and doing mainly programmes for young people and also some events and fundraising. So that's kind of my background. And so I saw this job come up here at the Albion and went for it. And I've been in post for nearly 3 months now.
And in that time, I guess, as I mentioned just now, that lockdown has been, you know, a key guide as to what's been happening. So in the 3 months that you've been doing there, I guess, you know, have you had the little red book thrown at you, build a bonfire thrown at you? Have you had the history thrown at you, or is it just a case of actually just getting on with fundraising?
Getting on with fundraising, but of course the history of the club is massively important. And being here and being at events, I went to their 25-year dinner at the stadium a couple of weeks ago, and there learnt so much about the stadium, about the club being homeless. And so, yeah, it's all becoming so much clearer and really interesting knowing about the history of and the struggles of the club from where they've been to where they are now.
Now, into the here and now, like I say, with AITC ramping up their events again, well, just let us know, what's on the horizon?
Well, I've got three main things coming up, all of which are going to be really exciting. The first is a quiz at the stadium on Thursday, the 26th of May. So what we're doing is we've got Rich Reynolds hosting, mm-hmm. and we're going to have a quiz that's general knowledge, but with a few Brighton and Hove Albion questions thrown in, where people can have teams up to six to take part in the quiz. And within the ticket price, which is £20 per head, they also get a hot meal as well.
Okay.
It'll be a night of entertainment. We've got, as I say, Rich Reynolds is hosting. We've got Guy Butters, Albion legend, holding a spot the ball competition. And we've also got lots of opportunities for AITC to raise money, but also for people to have as fun as well. Like we have a wine jackpot competition that's running alongside it, where people can win a bottle of wine that ranges. We've got some bottles that start at £10, and then we've got bottles of champagne up to £80. And so we've got various fun things running alongside the quiz.
Giving away a bottle of wine. If I had a bottle of wine as a raffle prize, then anyway, never mind that.
Well, we should have 100 bottles of wine to give away.
Wow.
So, yeah, so there's a huge chance of winning something really great by joining in.
See, there's one thing I hope that you've realised in the 3 months that you've been at the Albion is that, and obviously you've been here for match days and what have you, is you probably got to realise that the Albion fans on a collective basis have a bit of a drink problem.
Right. Well, I do say that any wine that is won on the night will not be able to be consumed within the stadium. It's to be taken home, possibly given away as a present.
No, just consumed at home. So, okay, so that's May 26th, yeah? Lounge are we talking about here?
It's going to be in the Mayor Wynne Baxter Lounge. May the 26th, doors open at 6 o'clock, close about 10.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's it. You can, for anyone that wants to register and wants to sign up, all the details are on the Albion in the Community website. And it's really easy just to click and sign up, and then you're booked on. We've only got space for 25 tables, teams of six.
Okay, great stuff. So if you're interested, how to get hold of you?
Just go on the AIT website. That's the best thing to do.
Okay, great stuff. And when the season finishes and it's all done and dusted, what have you got coming up through the summer?
Well, over the summer, what we're going to do is, I don't know if hopefully lots of fans will remember pre-COVID enjoying doing a Santa dash around the stadium.
It, that kind of dashing around anywhere actually passes me by. I'll leave that for other people. Well, my girth, you'd understand why.
Well, I've seen, obviously, I've seen lots of photos and heard lots about Santa runs where people obviously dress up in a blue and white Santa suit, run around the stadium, a real family event, all in aid of our community. Oh. And what we're going to be doing is, because it's been so long since we've done them and they're always popular, we're going to be running one in June, at the end of June, not dressed as Santa, but we're going to have every participant who buys a ticket will get a free T-shirt and a free entry, obviously, to take part. We're charging £12 for an adult, £8 for a child. Alongside the fun run, we're going to have loads of stalls, food and drink being served, kind of like a fairground thing. So really good for families to come along and have a bit of fun and enjoy the day. And that's going to be running on Saturday, the 25th of June.
And that's actually at the stadium, in the stadium.
Around the stadium for the fun run, and then around the north stand, we're going to have the majority of activities and games going alongside.
Great stuff. And so that's
Saturday, 25th of June.
And remind us and again, go to the AITC website. Yeah,
those will be on the AIT website, and you can just easily click to enter.
And I believe that before the season starts, you've got a cycling event for everyone.
That's right. We're bringing back the Brighton Breezy Cycle Challenge, where we've got three distances, all departing from the Amex Stadium on the 24th of July. So there's something for every level and every ability. We've got a 40-kilometre course, which obviously starts from the Amex. It goes up into the Downs, then round via Glyndebourne and Lewes back to the stadium. We've got a 70-kilometre one. And then we've got, for those who are really enthusiastic, a 100-kilometre one. And these longer routes cross the Downs and then up into the Sussex Weald and towards Crowber for the 110 one, before descending back down via Glyndebourne and Lewes again.
Now, I'm not a cyclist, not anymore, not given my girth, because I'll turn the wheels oval in no time at all. But even I know, cycling to Crowber is not for the faint-hearted. For those who've done it, you know, you can view it from the Devil's Dyke and you look across the Downs and across the Weald, and you can see there it is, Crowber, 600 feet above sea level. And you don't actually go into Crowber, do you? But you just skirt it. So it's going to be a challenge for those that want to do the long course, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. That's for the serious cyclists, that one. But actually, that route has been our most popular in previous years. But like I say, you've got that if you want. If you want more of a gentle ride, you've got the 40K as well, which is also enough of a challenge. From all the routes, we've got refreshment stops along the way. So free within the ticket price, which is 25 for the 40K, 30 for the 70 and 35 for the 100, you get obviously all refreshments included in that.
You're going to need them as well.
Yeah.
So if you want to get involved, it's July the 24th. If you want to know the details, it's on the AITC website. The maps are up there as well. And like I say, they're not for the faint-hearted. So in doing all these things, obviously the three things you got through the summer and all the things that you want to ramp up after that into the autumn and once the season starts again, what are the main things that Albion and the community are looking to be funding? I mean, we know we've had people on before, but do you know where the priorities are lying from this year onwards?
For all of our fundraising, it's going to all go into the work that Albion in the community does. A vast range of different programmes running. And just an example of what the money raised can do, £30 can pay for a specialist football to help give young people with a visual impairment opportunity to play, a special audio football. Mm-hmm. £100 can pay for a child in need to access our football programmes, which can be vital, not just in terms of developing their football skills, but more about developing personal skills, making friends, developing confidence and teamwork and things like that. £10 a month could help a child with a disability take part in an inclusive football session. So the range and depth of work we do around in our community is huge. And so every penny raised from these events will be going towards good causes.
Fantastic. I mean, and I think everyone who's an Albion fan does appreciate the work that Albion and the community do, and it's breathtaking. Like I say, the breadth, the depth, and everything that it's a real asset for, you know, a football club, which I do consider a progressive football club in a progressive city. And it's absolutely brilliant. So just to sign off, Nicky, from a personal point of view, I mean, like I say, you've been in the role for 3 months now. What are you looking to, without wishing to sound like a job interview, what are you looking to? What are you looking to?
A 5-year plan. Well, yeah. What I'm wishing to do is I'm just excited to have sort of live events. We've had some virtual things, obviously, but to have live events back, to be meeting with the fans, doing exciting things, a really wide range of things, and basically just raising as much money as we can whilst having fun for Albion in the community.
If people want to get involved, they can go to the AICC website, which is...
It's Albion and the Community, or one word, .org.uk. Then when you're on that homepage, all you need to do is go to is the Support Us tab, and then you can see fundraising events under that.
And from there, people can then see what's going on, get involved. Brilliant. Well, Nicky Giles, marketing and fundraiser at Albion the Community, thank you very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you are listening to the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As usual, we're brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Over 120,000 shirts on there now for you, for your a delight, and you go and have a look at them all, of course. But Phil has got I love this shirt, I've got to say. It's one of my favorites. But who would like to have a go at describing this one for me?
Does anyone know who this is for a start?
I'm gonna put my hand up. I was doing some research on that particular country last year, so I did actually know. So I will say that it is green and it is very beautiful. Shirt and it says Britannia on there, and that's where I'll stop.
Okay, Vicky, do you want to take over from there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's not many clubs who wear green, to be honest. And you know, if I had to take an initial and a presumably wrong guess, it would have been something like Saint Etienne. However, the sponsor logo on the front says Britannia, and the way that that's written looks Spanish to me. So I'm kind of thinking it's some sort of Spanish-speaking country. I'm only going to say it must be someone from Ecuador, just because Caicedo's played well, and that's the sort of thing that Phil would do.
Go on then, Louis. Put us out of our misery. Who is it?
It's a Deportivo Cali shirt.
You are absolutely correct.
And the vintage, I think, worn by Carlos Valderrama.
You are absolutely correct.
Don't know what year that is, but that'd be 80s and 90s.
Okay, probably. Yeah. I mean, this is what we've got to say on this one this week. It is the 1985-86 home shirt of Colombian Categoria Primera A side, Asociación Deportivo Cali, who hail from the city of Palmera. Deportivo Cali is one of the most successful teams in Colombia, having won 10 domestic league championships, one Copa Colombia, and one Superliga Colombiana. Their stadium, Estadio Deportivo Cali, originally had a capacity of 61,890, and it is the largest, well, was the largest football stadium in Colombia. And it was officially inaugurated in November 2008. But in 2010, its capacity was reduced to 55,000. Deportivo Cali is the only Colombian football club that owns its own stadium, but it's also the first Colombian team to reach the Copa Libertadores in 1978. In 2016, Forbes listed Deportivo Cali as the 36th most valuable football team in the Americas, and it's also the only club in Colombia to be owned by its fans. They were formed in 1912 and have three nicknames: Los Verde Blancos, which translates to be the Green Whites; Los Azurqueros, the Sugar Makers; and La Amazonia Verde, which translates to be the Green Fret. There's not a lot to link Cali to the Albion. Expect that Stephen Alzati plays for Colombia, but even he won't have played there, as the national team usually play their home games in Bogota. However, they do have a chairman named Marco Caicedo, and if we are to take a current theme, perhaps the world's most famous, fabulously coiffured player wore this very shirt, the one and only Carlos Valderrama. Thanks for that, Phil. And of course, like I said, you can see that and thousands of other over at oldfootballshirts.com.
Can I just say that as euphemisms go, the sugar makers for a Colombian side is a hell of a euphemism.
I also say that how dare you suggest that Carlos Valderrama has the best hair in football. I think we all know who has the hair in football.
René Higuita?
Stop it.
Looking more contemporary. More
Carlos Kaiser.
Louis, I'd say welcome back to the Raw. For those that don't realise, Louis is a filmmaker. His portfolio is interesting and diverse and fascinating, to say the least. Do you want to go quickly through the sort of like the previous sort of 6, 7, 8 years of what's been released and talk about the film that you got coming up?
Yeah, sure. So I think it all cracked. I did made a documentary on Football Manager back in the day, celebrating its 25th year of being alive. And then the sort of the one that sort of made me more of a film director rather than a TV director was a film about Carlos Kaiser, Kaiser the greatest footballer never to play football, who was a guy who had a 26-year professional career as a footballer, signed loads of contracts at famous clubs in Brazil and beyond, but never played a game. He was a con man who did anything he could do to get a contract and everything he could do not to play a game because he was genuinely terrible. After that, did a film called Stop the Tour with Peter Hain, which is looking at apartheid and the sporting protest against it, which kind of eventually brought down the regime. And then for my sins during lockdown, I made a Liverpool film for the BBC, which was, you know, painful.
Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah. I've enjoyed all of those. I mean, Stop the Tour, it's just a remarkable piece of work, actually.
Absolutely.
I mean, it is absolutely brilliant to watch. And if you is it still on BT?
Still on BT for another year, I think.
I mean, if you get the chance to watch it, I mean, it is absolutely, and obviously Kaiser as well. It's just, I mean, you got to interview some of the world's most famous footballers in that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's pretty varied, and I've got one coming out at the end of this month as well. Cue plug.
It's called Croatia Defining a Nation, Louis.
That's correct. So
tell me about it.
It's about the first great Croatian side, the 1998 Croatian team that finished third at the World Cup. And sort of out of nowhere, they're a very new country. And all those players, most of those players were part of the Yugoslav 1987 team, which won the World Championship. And they were considered to be the best youth side of all time. And they had some amazing players in there, like Robert Prozinecki, Davor Suka, Zvonimir Boban, and some absolute legends who all went on to have these amazing careers. But of course, their entire career happens with the backdrop of the Yugoslav wars and the disintegration of that state. And the film is basically looking at their careers in that context, but also the breakup of Yugoslavia with football as a real big factor behind that, and then creating Croatia as a nation. So football is used as a political tool and all of these things. The fans go and fight in the wars. I think not many people in the UK would know about it unless you remember it at the time, but it's very put together, sort of tied together by Zvonimir Boban, who was playing for Zagreb in 1990. And 2 days after the elections that had a Croatian sort of parliament, they were playing Red Star Belgrade, and he fly kicked a policeman in a massive riot. And the game never got played, and it's kind of considered the kick that started the war. And so his kind of story encapsulates anything, so that everything ramped up after that. So it's all brought together by all these legends, really.
So what made you decide to make this particular film? Because, I mean, it's quite a hard, dark subject, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, and look, I mean, it's become very relevant because of what's happened in Ukraine right now. And whilst you shouldn't conflate two different conflicts, there's some very similar themes in there with some pretty similar characters knocking around. We were basically we have a, you know, picture, you know, load of interesting stories, and we knew this one had a load of depth, that you don't just want to take on something that is, oh, look, isn't this team great? And there you are. It's got to have something a bit more interesting to that. So Stop the Tories, clearly that, because it's a whole protest movement against an apartheid state. This obviously, you know, had some amazing characters and amazing footballers. And for anyone who's younger than I am, you should. I mean, we've also been doing a project recently with footballers and haircuts. So I've been going to footballers' houses whilst they get their haircut recently. And I was complete opposite, but I was at Jude Bellingham's house about 3 weeks ago in Germany, and he . Brilliant guy, absolutely like knows everything about football, didn't know anything about these players, and he saw the trailer and he's like, who's this guy? And he had to go get Prozanetsky rules up. So we had up on his TV watching like all these Prozanetsky skills from back in the day, and he was like, this guy's an absolute baller, I love him, and all the rest of it. So these guys were genuinely amazing, and that team was amazing. But of course they all had to live through this dark stuff, like Slav Bilic, for instance.
Yeah,
could never play for Yugoslavia because his dad was Croatian nationalist, so he was banned, you know. He was a marked man. So he would never have played international football if they hadn't split up.
And Bilic speaks really well as well, doesn't he?
Oh, we did. And that was kind of like, you will start off these things thinking, oh, it's going to be good. And, you know, he's going to be great and all the rest of it. But when Slav turned up, I think it was about a 4-hour interview. And he just, he's an intelligent guy, right? But his dad was a university professor and a Croatian nationalist back in the day, so they were marked. So he really lived this whole thing and spoke very intelligently about the whole thing, and in a way different that I wasn't expecting. You know, yeah. I think he quite liked parts of Yugoslavia itself, whereas someone like Zvonimir Boban, again, equally fascinating. I mean, he's now number two at UEFA, was number two at FIFA, but he's also a professor of history at Zagreb. University. He was obviously more militant about really hating Yugoslavia and wanting to be, Croatia to be its own thing. But then he again spoke so intelligently and has such a way with words that it's just like, it's just, you could sit there listening to these guys all day about their experiences, and something we probably haven't had to live through in our own lives, I think, over here.
This film, I'm sorry to say, because we're getting to the end of the show here, but is this a cinema release or is it a TV documentary?
It's been taken up. Well, it's sort of both. It's going to be a bit of cinema, but it's also been, there's a new platform called FIFA Plus, which they sort of released this whole sort of their own Netflix of sport thing, where they're providing loads of games. I think it's like 10,000 games a year free to charge to the user. And then they're doing proper stories like this. So they've acquired it and it'll be available at the same time it premieres. So we're premiering we've got a premiere in Zagreb with Boban and Stimac, and the current teams of Modric will be there. And exactly the time that presses play, it goes live on the platform. So,
Is it going to be a UK TV cinema release? Is it going to be like Duke of York, for instance?
Possibly. I think that platform's very new. They've kind of acquired it as their thing. They do have a deal with another streamer, which I'm not allowed to talk about. Apart from it might not only be on that thing. But look, I mean, the point is that it's, you know, that you can download it on your TV and your phone, and it's all there. I mean, I was reasonably skeptical about the whole thing myself, and then they've done a good job on it. And the stories that they're commissioning are, you know, proper stories. You know, there's not just this access or celebrity driven stuff. So it's good.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, good luck with it, mate. I hope it does well for you. Seriously, good luck with it.
Okay. Al, just before we finish up, we've got a quick notice board.
Yeah, just very, very quickly. I mean, obviously, we've just had the first leg of the Renf game, finished 1-1 in Croydon. What a lovely backdrop that was. But the second leg is going to take place at Sussex FA headquarters, Culver Road, Lancing, on Friday, 27th of May. Please do come along, support the lads. You know, if the first team can do well and everyone else can do, and the under 23s are on a roll, then why not the Renf team? Because I mean, anything to beat Crystal Palace would be fabulous. So 27th of May at Culver Road, Lancing, Sussex FA HQ, come along for the second leg of the Renf game.
Okay.
The under 23s managed to beat Worthing for the Sussex Senior Cup final. The fact that they've managed to beat a team that's actually had a really good season, Vicky, surely bodes well for the future of the Albion's conveyor belt.
Well, I hope so. It's always difficult to tell, isn't it, with the you never really know. I never really know how to gauge it with the Sussex Senior Cup. It's kind of like a, yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you're playing against sort of amateur players, but they're still sort of, I suppose, youngsters playing against men in the main, aren't they? So hopefully it's another good sign, another, you know, for everything that's gone before.
No, I didn't. I heard good things about Moran, the Irish kiddie.
Yeah.
What do people make of Toe? Is he, how do you say it? Is it Toe Lodge or Toe Lodge?
Toe Lodge.
He's a bit like me, too large.
Very good.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Because, I mean, every time you see the highlights, he always looks great. And I didn't realise it was him because he's got hair again now, hasn't he? But,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like he could be quite a bit of a player in something that we don't have. But I guess Connolly looked like that as well.
But Talage is the guy that went on. He scored, was it 9 goals in one game for the Switzerland 18s? I think it was.
Was that him? That's a bit selfish, isn't it? No, I watched the game myself, and I think that for me, the player of the match or the Albion man of the match was Jack Spong. He's the captain. He's tiny, which in itself isn't necessarily, hopefully, a barrier to him going on to having a successful career. But I think, as Vicky said, it's actually quite difficult to tell, because when you excel for the under-23s, you know, you're playing against your age group, and it shows that, yes, you're the best in that age group. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be in a position to then go on and look ahead and be able to grow as a player. I mean, we've had plenty of... Well, look at Aaron Connolly. You know, he was absolutely amazing for the under-23s, and they finished top of their division. He was the leading scorer, and his career really has kind of ground to a halt. So it's not... you know, everything. And yet, you know, we then have other players come through who are starting to blossom, not necessarily here, but other places. So it's kind of an interesting sort of a moment in history, I think, where you're going to say, well, I saw them win. It was a good win. They played really well. You know, there are certain players you can see who are going to probably make the grade, but not necessarily here. Because like the step up from under 23 to a progressing Premier League side is only ever getting bigger all the while we're progressing under Graham Potter.
But that's the plan, isn't it?
How do you solve that, though? Because the under 23s isn't really competitive, right? I mean, do we need to bring back reserve football? How does it... Because it feels like it's, you know, there's a... players get to a certain level, and if they don't assimilate into the first team, then that could almost be career over at that point for some of these guys.
Well, I guess probably Ben White is a classic example of how it can work. You know, he spent a year on loan in League Two, then League One, then the Championship, and thankfully Leeds United fans all, you know, upsold his value to us, you know, so we should be grateful to them. And we'll get on to Leeds United in a minute.
So he wasn't playing under 23 though, Alan, was he?
Sorry?
You know, he was playing competitive football, not
under 23s. No, he did play for the 23s, though. He played a few games for us. He did actually, I think he actually played in one of the, didn't he play in the Carling Cup game against Villa?
He played against Southampton.
Southampton.
Ben White did, yeah. So I think his was the textbook step up, but not everyone necessarily does that. And in some cases, we send a player out on loan, only to realise that's where they're going to end up staying.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, I mean, the idea is basically we've got this academy, and the idea is obviously for the players to make the grade and step up to the first team. And Graham Potter has actually provided that pathway. And if you are good enough and he sees something in you, you will be given that opportunity. But and we have got players out on loan. And we've got Carl Rushworth, who a really great goalkeeper. We saw him play a few times for Worthing, didn't we, Al? And for here.
He's just been
named player of the season by Walsall's fans. We've got Van der Heck at Blackburn. He's just been named player of the season by their fans. Redick Hedger, he's also at Blackburn. He's got their goal of the season. And these players are all going to be coming back to the Albion next year. So.
You've also got Matt Clark was named player of the season. Yeah, I think he's still on loan as well. So, yeah, I mean, they're not necessarily under 23 players, but, you know, they are players who you get to realise that we're buying these players up and hopefully sending them to the right clubs where they're going to get the appropriate amount of experience, where they're then going to step up and make the grade. So I suspect in answer to your question, Louis, and obviously I think probably you and I know about as much about this, but I'm going to make a supposition here is that stepping up from under 23 to the first team is actually such a massive leap that it's almost dangerous. So you have to make those interim steps. And all the while we send someone out to League One or Championship, then I think that that is actually only ever going to be part of their education, for which they'll then go up and hopefully be good enough for us next season. Above and beyond that, yeah.
Was that a mistake with Connolly then? Because, I mean, like Connolly, I mean, he's, I think he's a good player still. I mean, there's a player in there. And I just wonder, like, did we take too much of a risk on him in that first season? He obviously scored that brace, huge confidence. And then he's kind of going on loan after he's got a complex of, well, I'm a Premier League striker, why am I playing for the likes of... And all the other issues with Connolly aside, should that have been managed better in hindsight originally?
Vicky, have you got a thought on this?
Yeah, I think, yeah, Connolly, I completely agree with you, actually. I do think there is a player there. I don't think he fits the sort of category of sort of players that we've had in the past. With the greatest of respect to Scott Ramsey and Chris McPhee and these these strikers that we've produced over the years that have largely come to nothing. You know, the best we probably could come up with is Jake Robinson, and even, you know, he was never going to be anything that, that other clubs were queuing up to sign from us. So I think with Connolly, I do think there is a player. I agree, but I just... I think this, it's in his head with him, isn't it? I think sometimes he comes across as though he likes the idea of being a footballer more than having to do the actual work to be one, you know, if that makes sense. And
The fact that he's got a tattoo of himself on his arm, Vicky.
You're joking.
No.
Yeah, it's off his goal against Spurs, isn't it, I think? Yeah.
Well, you know, and you can't blame a player for being excited about that. And the goals he has scored have actually been pretty good goals. You know, they're not... And against Premier League defences, it's just there haven't been enough of them. And I think... there's clearly a confidence issue going on. I think being a striker is a very hard thing. It's the hardest thing as a young player to do, perhaps alongside a goalkeeper. You know, you can kind of hide a bit if you're a midfielder, and certainly if you're a defender. Look how many defenders we've produced over the years that have slotted in and been fine. So it's the hardest role to do, and yeah, I wouldn't envy anyone that.
Yeah, but Evan Ferguson, he's another one off the production line. He's one that's been scoring a lot of goals and being a playmaker as well for the 23s this season. He's been given an opportunity. He's made his Premier League debut. I think it's a case of how you manage his minutes and expectations. I mean, that is the key word here, isn't it? Is expectation. You see these players. We had it with Connolly. We saw him score 2 goals on his debut. And we thought, oh my God, we finally found one. And then all of a sudden, there's this heap of pressure on their shoulders. I think Potter's had his fingers burnt with that a little bit, and he's actually managing Ferguson better to the point where even he may, despite us wanting him to be involved in the first team straight away, will probably go out on loan next season.
Well, Ferguson's still only 17, so he's still got, I suspect he'll probably go, he'll be sticking around here. And don't forget, he's only been here a year. I suspect he'll be here at least another year. And let's say it's under 23, so he's actually five, six years below the maximum age for this age group. So even then, I mean, he's a kid, a big kid, but a kid playing amongst sort of older people. So yeah, he's done well to make that step up. I think it was probably in times of desperation, but he's done well to make that step up. And you're right about him, you know, he is still an under 23 player who's occasionally played for the first team rather than him being a first team player who is actually asked to play for the under 23s again. Now, I can see him not going out on loan just yet and carry on his education here for the time being. Anyway, so yeah, it was great. Congratulations to the Albion under 23 side. I'm really pleased for the likes of Andrew Cross and Gary Dicker. You know, you can see the hard work they put in, and you know, you can even see the whole setup and stuff. I mean, I had someone behind me saying, oh, I think that these boys have been watching Graham Potter's side. You think? No, it's all part of the same philosophy. It's the same thing. They're all talk together. And yes, you could see how they're confident amongst each other, even when they weren't playing that well during a given part of the game. I think personally, they were worthy winners. And I'm kind of buoyed by seeing that lot looking comfortable on the ball, playing, you know, really, really well. And in the stripes for the Albion, so good for them. So talking of players who've, you know, done well for the Albion, it was the awards evening a couple of days ago.
Yes, it was.
Probably the least surprising result for player of the season. Vic, you couldn't look beyond Crystal Tips, could you?
Yeah, no, I think there were other they didn't sort of publish a top three or anything, did they? But
They have now. Veltman second, McAllister third.
Okay. Well, McAllister, interesting.
Yeah.
Was that Leeds fans voting again, or another link to Leeds? I think it's entirely justified. I think it's no surprise to anyone that he's won the awards. It's quite nice that he's won the players' awards as well, because you know sometimes you get quite a different vote with those kind of things between you know what the fans think and what the players think amongst themselves as a group of mates. But no, I think it was right. It was the right choice, and all about personal opinions, isn't it? But I think he's impressed everyone this year.
Louis, I mean, do you go along with the award?
It was always going to be Cucurella. I mean, he's just been brilliant and consistent. Has he actually played every single minute since he joined?
Only since he arrived. So he came in the third game against Brentford.
Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable. Not being subbed has been. I don't ever remember a bad game of him, to be honest. He's always looking to get forward. He's a great defender. He's clearly got a very jovial personality, as you said in the main podcast. I mean, I think everyone has a man crush on him. I don't know anyone in football, Brighton fan or not, who doesn't love him. And so it's a bit like when we finally went up to the Premier League and Bruno was suddenly recognised across the country with his beard. He was so distinctive, and everyone knew who Bruno was and loved him, right? Because he just looked a character. It's the same with Cucurella. You can just tell that he's a nice guy. And he means well. So yeah, fully deserved. And great that he won the Lewis Dunk Award as well. But I mean, it was a season though where I think Cucurella is a standout, but it would have been hard to pick a best player out of the rest of them, because everyone's been pretty good, I think. I mean, you know, there was one point of the season that Bissouma was clearly going to win it before all the things that happened or didn't happen. Yeah, Cucurella's obviously been strong. If you're looking at the last few weeks, you'd hard to look past Trossard.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's talk about Leo then, because Leo, he's got a year left in his contract. He's certainly being courted by other clubs this summer. Ideally, I would hope we would put another bigger improved deal on the table. But this is Brighton. You don't come to Brighton for the money. You come for the project.
This is the thing about Trossard. He's made noises about wanting to go to a big six club. But then I think that's almost like any given person's inner monologue coming out loud here. And unfortunately said it to the press. And the issue here is that I'll put this to you, Vicky. Is he good enough to go to a top six club?
Yeah, I think, you know, the top six as it stands at the moment, there are teams that undoubtedly, I'm not necessarily sure he would get into a Man City or a Liverpool side, for example, although, you know, when he's on form, he could probably do the job. But, you know, if you look at Arsenal and Spurs and Chelsea, well, they're top six clubs, and I don't see any reason why he couldn't play for them, because he's already scored goals against them recently. Mm. You know, he's certainly at that level. He's no worse than anybody that you could pick up front for Arsenal at the moment, for argument's sake. Mm. Maybe not Kane and Son at Spurs, but certainly some of the others, maybe even Chelsea.
Yeah, but Vicky, if we carry on the trajectory that we're on at the moment, we could quite easily qualify for that top six at the moment.
Baby steps, eh? Let's. Whatever happens, Adi, I will still be starting next season looking at the clubs who is going to be in the bottom three, and that's always going to be. You know, we're going to have to move on a long way from where we are for me to ever stop thinking. Who's going to be the bottom three clubs? Who's going to finish below us? Because that's years of following the Albion.
But to pick up on your point, Alan, about like, oh, it was a mistake, he said it to the press. I'm kind of happy, not that bothered by the fact he said it to the press. He said it in quite a nice terms, and so it, that I've got a year left. Is a top six club interested in me? But also I have to look at it here. I'm really happy here and enjoying it, right? I mean, it's... for me, that's ultimate progress, because, you know, a couple of years ago, it could have been, well, anyone that's not in a relegation scrap, could have been Leicester, could have been West Ham, right? Now it's like, well, actually, it has to be a really top club, because otherwise, why ruin a good thing here? Mm. And yes, I think he's good enough to play for a top six side. He's regular Celtic for Belgium now.
If you look at the celebrations on Saturday, I mean, there's a lot of togetherness in that squad. Yeah. And, okay, admittedly, we know we're not the biggest players in the division. We never will be.
We're still bottom six, mate.
But, you know, these players that they're part of something here. They're part of something exciting that's building. And I joke about the top six thing. I know Tony wants to cement top 10 regularly. Hopefully we're on target to secure that for the very first time in our history this year. And that's massive, by the way.
But you look at the difference between where we are and the top six now. I mean, even in terms of points difference, we're talking about a 20-point gap here, or probably more. And so when Vicky talks about baby steps, I think it's absolutely right. That's going to take at least another 3-4 years to close that gap if you've really got designs on top six. Plus, it will take an enormous investment in resources, which will probably also include having a couple of seasons in Europe. And one of the things that concerns me is if we do end up landing that seventh place spot, and let's dream for a moment, we don't have the resources to be able to compete, I don't think, in the Premier League and make a serious effort to having a go at Europe. You know, the best we could do is dip our toe in. We don't have enough, strength in depth to be able to do that without, a summer of enormous, and I'm talking enormous, investment.
I can argue that point, but Al, Lou.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would probably get to argue the same point as you, AD, was that we also have to look at where we are at the club and why players like Trossard, like Bissouma, like Caicedo are coming to us, right? They're not here to play for Brighton of Albion for the rest of their careers. They're here to get good quality Premier League football, improve their name and get sold on, right? That's the business model. Look at Borussia Dortmund, and Haaland's just moved to Manchester City for a buyout clause that's quite low for some of his talent, right? We'll be doing it the same to these guys to attract look at the Caicedo. He's an amazing player, an absolutely amazing player, but he'll be here with us 3-4 years at best, and we'll go. So why not? As for the Europe point, I actually think something like the Conference League has actually been very successful, right? Because the standard that we'll be playing against won't be that great in that league unless you get towards the latter stages. So, you know what? I think we probably could do all right in that. The Europa League would be a bit tougher.
Yeah. But I mean, Louis, you mentioned Caicedo there. I mean, how long do you think it will be before he wins the Ballon d'Or?
I think it could be next year.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, because if we got into the Champions League, and won the FA Cup, and Ecuador win the World Cup, can I be close? I mean, he's
could be close. 19 years could be close. But I mean, going back to the point about being in Europe, I mean, you only have to look at West Ham this season. Okay, they faltered at the semi final stage. And they've got a threadbare squad, and they've managed to basically compete both at the top end of the Premier League and in Europe this season. Yes,
their resources are huge in comparison to ours. So I can't, to make a comparison between what Brighton have and what West Ham have, I think really is kind of, this is where we need Kieran to actually nail this point. But you know full well that West Ham are kind of mid to upper table in terms of, wages and resources. So I think that the comparison, I think, is, doesn't really, for me, hold water.
Just because also with West Ham as well, it's a very different style of football. And if you look at the sort of possession stats and the pressing stats, the Albion's game is very much about high pressing and chasing down. And that West Ham tend to have not a lot of possession. They sort of get the ball front to back fairly quickly, fairly one-dimensional. And so, the running around, the levels of exhaustion aren't perhaps quite
same. Okay, I'll take that point. But I mean, okay, well, before we close off, we've just seen that Inetwepu got goal of the season. We'll obviously we have the official Raw goal of the season coming up in a couple of weeks. But Vicky Louis, I mean, what was your actual personal favourite goal of the season?
I didn't personally vote for Inetwepu's. Not that one anyway. I mean, if I had to pick a three, I really liked Inetwepu's goal at Arsenal, because I thought that was a lovely move. I might have a little bit of what Potter said in the interview about, it's recency kicking in there, isn't it? But, the Pascal Gross goal at the weekend. Maupay's overhead kick. I don't know. I suppose there's still a part of me that thinks Mwepu didn't quite mean it, but he says he did. So who am I to doubt him? If he, assuming he did mean that, he was being honest, that's a great goal.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Vicky, I can't believe you haven't let it bounce. Louis?
For sheer joy, it's Mopé. against Palace.
Oh, you have let it bounce. Okay.
Yeah, I have let it bounce. No, I do agree with Vicky. I did think that Arsenal goal was fantastic. I tell you what, the one thing I look at the goals of the season, I've forgotten that McAllister's one against Everton was fantastic as well. It's, mm-hmm. It sort of slipped my mind a bit. It was a good bunch to pick from. Probably the best of recent years.
Yeah. Absolutely. So that just leaves us actually for all the things and the modern malaise of social media that somewhere down the line, and I can't help thinking that this was about as authentic as a Jeremy Beadle home movies clip thing. We've got a seagull saviour, a Dutch seagull saviour. Has anyone seen Joel Veltman trying to save a seagull here?
Amazing. Made my weekend even better.
It was. I particularly enjoyed his oven gloves that he was wearing.
He seemed to have different gloves because, you know, by the end of it, he had an oven glove on one hand and sort of a gardening glove on the other hand. I appreciate it. If I'm picking a seagull out of the chimney, then I'm definitely wearing gloves. And he's done quite well that he didn't appear to have crap all over his carpet.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you so much to Louis Miles, to Vicky Rees, to Alan Wares. I've been Eddie Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.